Recapping the weekend in sports and previewing the week ahead. This is FM Talk 106.5 Sports Night with Dalton Orwig and Corey LeBounty.
All right, here we go. FM Talk 106.5. Corey LeBounty. I'm Dalton Orwig. There, over there, Ian Blair. And this is Sports Night on FM Talk 106.5. Count your days. Not much more time until we are in the college football season. Actually, tonight, you have this show tonight. Then you have another show 1 week from tonight. That'll be August 16th. And then one more show after that. And my math starts getting hazy. I believe that would be August 23rd. And college football beginning, I think, August 28th.
You got it. Saturday, August 28th.
The first games. Now, if it's anything like it's been the last few years, and I haven't really taken a long, hard look at that first week's schedule, but you get like eight games, and every now and then there's like a Notre Dame involved or some Power 5 conference, but for the most part, those are the lesser teams, right? And I don't know, Corey, you look like you're looking at the schedule, but I'm not sure if you are.
Yes. Nebraska, Illinois will pretty much be the headliner to me in week one.
And then the rest are just, you know, but, you know, after being starved for football, we're probably going to be watching that. And then really it's the week afterwards when the SEC and the rest of the nation gets rolling. And I think the Tennessee Vols are the first SEC team to take the field. That will be that Thursday night. So the first Thursday in September, the Vols will be on the field. And then come Saturday, you'll have a whole lot of SEC teams. And then I think with that being Labor Day weekend, we'll get some Sunday games and Monday games as well.
We do get those Sunday games. I mean, just a slate full of those Saturday games. The Sunday game is Notre Dame and Florida State, and the Monday night Labor Day game is Louisville and Ole Miss.
So, man, looking forward to that, and a lot to talk about tonight regarding football. And then, of course, that weekend will lead into, after that, the NFL takes over on Mondays, Thursdays, and Sundays, and you get your college football on Saturdays. So we have made it. You know, it's been a long, hard, hot summer so far, but we've had plenty of sports to discuss. And the Olympics wrapping over the weekend. I want to get to that here in just a few minutes. But you mentioned Florida State and their first game coming up here that Sunday night of the first Sunday in September. And big sad news from over the weekend as Bobby Bowden passed away. And it didn't happen very much later than he announced that he had a terminal illness. That was back July 21st when the Bowden family came out and said that he would be passing away soon. And his son, Terry, later said that it was pancreatic cancer that the old coach had. And he passed away yesterday morning in his home in Tallahassee, Florida, which is fitting, right? Because Florida and Bobby Bowden, Tallahassee, one and the same. And he was such an amazing coach. And I completely didn't even realize that he began at Samford. That's where he went
Birmingham
to school.
Guy.
That's where he coached first. It was known as Howard College back then. And Dan Brennan this morning tells me, see, there's, I know a lot about football trivia and football history, but there's some stuff that escapes me. Jimbo Fisher was the quarterback at Samford under Bobby Bowden. I had no idea.
That's the relationship that he built. I mean, here's a guy that I had an opportunity to meet when Coach Godfrey brought him down for one of the bowl games. I think it was the Dollar General Bowl at the time. But when I tell you, you just really never saw him curse. And dadgummit was something that you loved. Over 377 career wins, over a 40-year college career. And when you start looking at the 90s dominance that the Florida State Seminoles had and all the NFL guys, it was equivalent to what Alabama is putting out now. And it was just amazing. You wanted, if you wanted to play football, you wanted to go and be a Florida State Seminole.
No doubt about that. And 34 seasons, one losing season at Florida State, 14 consecutive years where they finished in the top five of the AP Top 25 poll, 12 ACC championships, a national title in 1993 and one in 1999. Just an unbelievable run there at Florida State. And you mentioned he wouldn't cuss. You know, very faithful man. I want to play some audio. This was Bobby Bowden talking about what he wants his legacy to be. This was from Bobby Bowden a while back. Let's see if I can get this right.
I'd like to say Bobby Bowden served God's purpose for his life. Now, that to me is a greatest win you can get, you know, because, you know, we Christians think we're going to go on. We think there's more out there, you know. And so if that was true, I would love for that to be my legacy.
So his faith, obviously, a very important part of his life. And you've followed the athletes mm-hmm. from here in Mobile forever. Did Florida State ever have were there guys like itching from Mobile and Baldwin counties to make it over to Florida State, or did that recruiting bubble not quite make it this far?
I don't think, you know, their recruiting was here. Mm-hmm. They did have coaches who would come and look at the talent in this area, but again, Florida State was just that machine.
Yeah.
And they didn't have to go outside of Florida really to get any type of talent at that time, but you mentioned his faith, and I think that's what he wanted his legacy to be, as a man of faith, and teaching his players the importance of his faith. And that's what I'm going to remember Bobby Bowden for.
As I was listening to a broadcaster earlier discuss Bobby Bowden's career and legacy, and it seemed like Miami was that roadblock that just kept coming up over and over for him. And he may have won more titles if it weren't for the U. But the same broadcaster was saying it wasn't even about the titles for Bobby Bowden, and that he might not have been as happy as he was having won two titles, but even if he'd never won a national championship, that wasn't exactly what it was about for him.
Wide left, wide right, you can pick a wide or a short field goal situation that cost Bobby Bowden an opportunity to play for a national championship, because when they actually went to the football playoffs and started having an opportunity, it was like maybe the year after Tennessee won the inaugural game there. And the thing that I remember most, again, is his ability and what his players said about him, whether it was Deion Sanders, whether it was Warwick Dunn, whether it's Peter Warwick, Derek Brooks, all these guys spoke to the type of father figure that he was.
That's good stuff. And one last bit of audio I want to play here before we move on to something else. But, you know, you got to get the Pope's take on this, the Pope of college football, Nick Saban, and what he thinks of Bobby Bowden and his career. Here's what Nick Saban had to say. I can't recall if this was after Bowden passed away yesterday, or if Coach Saban was asked this earlier, but here's what he had to say about Bobby Bowden.
You know, Coach Bobby Bowden's passing is something that really has saddened all of college football. This guy was probably the greatest ambassador, at least in my view, or one of the great ambassadors of all time, because he coached, he had success coaching, but he was also one of the greatest people. And set an outstanding example for everyone in our profession in terms of you don't have to dislike somebody, you don't have to discredit somebody that you're competing against, that your example of being a good person is, you know, something that can help us all professionally. He wasn't always just about him. He was always about helping other people.
So some very kind words there from Nick Saban regarding Bobby Bowden, and a Hall of Famer that will for sure be missed in college football. Let's get into the Olympics a little bit here before we go to the break. And we ended up, you know, the United States, as much talk as there was about the wokeness and people not watching and athletes not living up to the standard they need to, whether it's Simone Biles or the women's team or the men's basketball team, you look at the end, the scoreboard at the end, and the United States still the most dominant country by far athletically. And, well, we can get into some other subjects, but let's just stick to the athletics right now. And we won in the gold medal count, 39-38, a come-from-behind victory, down by two gold medals to China entering the final day. And then you had the women's basketball team come out and rout Japan. That wasn't even a real game. Women's volleyball got it done. And a cyclist from California, Jennifer Valenti, ended up winning gold. So the United States edges China 39-38 in gold medals. And absolutely crushed the rest of the countries when it comes to total medals, with 113 total. That's 25 more than second place China, and the only country to win 100 medals. So that's three summer games in a row the U.S. has led in gold medals, and seven summer games in a row they've led in total medals. Just absolutely dominant, Corey.
And that's what you want. I mean, whether it was a come-behind victory or not, when you start looking at Allyson Felix being the most decorated track and field women's athlete, surpassing Carl Lewis, that's very impressive in and of itself. Seven consecutive gold medals for the women's basketball team. congratulations to them. Didn't expect anything else. The men had to struggle but found a way to ultimately win it. And when you start looking, who are the heroes? Who do you want to look at? I mean, look no further than Mobile's own Paige Madden, winning a silver medal. So congratulations to her, as we spoke on last week. But Caleb Dressel getting it done in the pool too.
Yeah. Ledecky, Dressel. There's been so many. What about that heavyweight wrestler? Well, I can't remember what weight class he was in. Big boy. And a, like, come-from-behind last-second win for the gold medal. Absolutely some good stuff. We'll get into that basketball men's gold medal coming up. Also, the Hall of Fame announcements over the weekend and Peyton Manning's speech. Plus, coming up at the bottom of the hour, Brad Edwards. We're going to talk some Alabama football. He's got a book coming out this week. More on that coming up. Sports Night, FM Talk 106.5.
So good, baby, baby.
Shake it, shake it.
It was all a dream. I used to read Word Up magazine. Salt and pepper and Heavy D up in the limousine. Hanging pictures on my wall. Every Saturday, Rap Attack, Mr. Magic, Molly Mall. I let my tape rock till my tape pop. Smoking the bamboo.
Welcome back, FM Talk 106.5. Sports Night, Dalton Corwick, Corey LeBounty, Ian Blair. On this Monday night, coming up next segment, we're going to do all things SEC football with Brad Edwards. You may recognize him from ESPN. He's got a cool book coming out, and I think it comes out this week. I can't wait to check it out. It's called Dynasty by the Numbers, Why Alabama Now Owns the Greatest Decade-Plus Run in College Football History. And that's saying something on the heels of just talking about Bobby Bowden and all the things he's done and all the dynasties in the history of college football. But certainly Nick Saban and the Alabama dynasty is up there near or at the very top. We'll talk with Brad Edwards not only about that and the past, but also what we can look forward to this year with Alabama and Auburn and the rest of the SEC, and even further into the future with Texas and Oklahoma joining the conference. So you won't want to miss that. The Hall of Fame induction ceremonies, they had two this weekend because last year's was canceled because of COVID. And obviously, there's no bones made about who the biggest name was in the induction ceremony, and that was Peyton Manning. And I want to play some audio from him coming up in just a little bit. But it seems to me like maybe Peyton Manning, all these deals he's turned down for broadcasting, even though he and Eli will be broadcasting on ESPN Monday Night Football 10 weeks this year, I think that he might have Goodell's job in the crosshairs. We could talk about that as well, but let's look at these classes that were inducted over the weekend. So class of 2020, actually, let's just start from the top here. 2021, Alan Faneca, I think that was well-deserved. I mean, dude was it seemed like he played forever, and he was a 12-time Pro Bowler, didn't miss a game in his career. Nine-time Pro Bowler, 16 first-time All-Pro. And one of only 12 guards in league history to be a first-team All-Pro six or more times. How about Calvin Johnson getting in? And one of my favorite tweets that I read over the weekend, let me see if I can find it really quickly. It was basically
saying his age.
Well, he was a freshman
at Georgia Tech
when Tom Brady won his third Super Bowl.
Yeah,
Calvin Johnson played his entire Georgia Tech career, which 1,200 yards receiving in one season at Georgia Tech while they were running the wing T, that's pretty amazing. But he plays his entire Georgia Tech career, goes into the NFL, plays for the lowly Detroit Lions, and is basically the only reason to watch the Lions for so many years, retires, waits the 5 years, and is inducted into the Hall of Fame. And Tom Brady's getting ready for another training camp, or he's playing in training camp right now at the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Now, that stat says more about Tom Brady than it does Calvin Johnson, but still an absolutely dominant receiver. And there's no telling if he had been on a great passing team. I mean, they were playing from behind a lot.
Sure.
You have to say that. But can you imagine if he played alongside Tony Romo for all that time, or Peyton Manning for all that time? What all of that would have meant for Calvin Johnson's career?
36 he turns next month, and he's just the third player to be enshrined when he was 35 or younger at the time of his enshrinement. And that speaks volumes. Again, you knew that the ball was going to Megatron when Detroit was playing, and when they needed to catch down the stretch, it was going to Megatron, and Calvin was the man, and I thought he was should have been inducted as a first-timer, and I'm glad he was.
So he was eligible last year, huh?
Yes.
Okay. That's news to me. Ian?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. If Megatron – and I will say this, and I will defend this. I will defend this till the day that I stop talking football, which will be the day that I'm in the grave, all right? Calvin Johnson, Megatron. There's a reason why he is Megatron, and there's no Optimus Prime to stop him, right? If he would have played with even a half-decent quarterback, his name would be in the conversation for the greatest receiver of all time, and you cannot convince me otherwise.
Well, he did have Stafford there, right, for a few years. But
yes.
He didn't get a whole lot of Stafford, and I think this year we'll find out more about how great of a quarterback Matthew Stafford is or could have been and how much of that was Detroit's stain.
Well, true. But, I mean, how many MVPs did Stafford win? When was Stafford really considered like a top five, top three quarterback in the league?
Right.
So, I mean.
I'd love to run it back with him on the Saints or with the Patriots.
Him and Drew would have probably won like three championships.
And really,
minimum.
The size, his sheer size, nothing like that since DK Metcalf seems to be maybe the closest.
He's got some
to
shades
it.
Of Megatron for sure. But yeah. I think we let DK be DK. But man, I tell you, Megatron, one of my favorite players that I've ever seen, and man.
Mm-hmm.
Well deserved. And like Corey said, should have been in there sooner than what he was. It was kind of shocking to see that his name came up on that ballot now versus, you know, like 2019 or so.
John Lynch is in now. Of course, a absolutely dominant safety in the NFL. Played for the Bucs for so long and then the Broncos. Someone who finished his career with the Broncos, Peyton Manning. And that's really the only speech I watched this weekend, and I thought it was a fantastic speech. Of course, he got to go up after his good buddy and teammate Edgerrin James was up the night prior. Tony Dungy was in the house. Marvin Harrison, right? Pretty much anyone who's anyone in the NFL was there if they were a part of Manning's career. And I pulled this clip from his speech. I thought this was pretty good. And this kind of points to what I think the future holds for Peyton Manning, and maybe that $45 million a year job that's currently held by Roger Goodell.
I never expected to stand on this stage tonight. If it weren't for those busts and the memories of forever loyal fans, tonight's details would blur and cheers would fade. However, our hearts will cradle the memories forever. Throughout our lives as players, coaches, staffs, and fans, we've become essential to the sports landscape. I don't know about you, but I'm not done with this game. I never will be. I'm committed to ensuring its future, and I hope you will join me in that commitment.
Now, there's been some slam dunk first-year Hall of Famers in the past, but Peyton Manning certainly near the top of that list for slam dunks.
He really is. It's a no-brainer. I just love – he's such a great one-liner. He can deliver those zingers. I think that's why him and Eli – are going to be priceless to watch when they get in the booth calling football games together.
Charles Woodson, he made it in. That was a long time coming, I'd say. And with them being Heisman finalists together, Manning and Woodson, their careers were kind of always linked together like that since their college days. Tom Flores, as a coach, made it in, which it's funny because I think it was Coors Light or just Coors who began Coors. Yeah, they began the campaign to get Flores into the Hall of Fame. Those commercials only ran for like 2 weeks before Flores was selected. So
I loved it.
Good job, Coors, or you paid a lot of money for an ad campaign that did not last very long.
Not to mention he has the beer cans with his face on it that he can keep for enshrinement also.
The 2020 modern era, Steve Atwater is in. You also have Isaac Bruce, such a great receiver with the LA Rams, and Kurt Warner for so long. Steve Hutchinson, who played for a number of teams in the league, a really good guard. And Edgerrin James, he made it in. Troy Polamalu, though, I followed him as close or more closely than any others in that 2020 class.
I would have to go with Edgerrin James, and I think he had the quote of the entire weekend when he said, "My career started with gold teeth and ended with this gold jacket."
That's good.
And what he was referring to is not the plaque on his teeth, but the gold grill, the gold teeth that he used to have in his mouth. And that really made him stand out. And he said, you know, the stereotypical look of him, people didn't want him to have those dreads and to have those gold teeth, but now look at him, he's in the Hall of Fame.
You know, it really says something that he shined the way he did with Peyton Manning at quarterback because, I mean, there have been some good Patriots running backs throughout the years, but none that really, you know, played like Edgerrin James did. And he played so well that he was given the ball more often than probably necessary in that Colts offense. You probably could have seen Peyton throw some more. But there's the Hall of Fame classes. And looking at the text line here, Dave says, "Now we got to get Hines Ward into the Pro Football Hall of Fame." Yeah, I think, I don't know, he's been eligible, I'm sure. Is Hines already in? He isn't in the Hall of Fame yet, is he?
I don't think Hines Ward is. I know Bill Cowher and Harold Carmichael were both in too. So that's big time when you start talking about those people that were inducted. But Dalton, Hines Ward was a very special player, very versatile, fun to watch, whether it was at Georgia or whether it was in the NFL too. Was one of those guys that I always, when I played the video game, wanted to know where he was lined up.
Yeah, no doubt.
So I could either stop him or be him, one of the two.
Such a hard hitter for such a small man at that position, but just an amazing player. We'll see whether Hines Ward goes here soon. Looking at the 2022 class, you have Andre Johnson eligible. That will be an interesting take. Steve Smith, I think, will be in, right? Anquan Boldin. How about DeMarcus Ware, former Troy Trojan and longtime Dallas Cowboy? If I had my druthers, he would be in. Devin Hester will be eligible. Is his special teams ability enough to get him into the Hall?
Absolutely. The best special teams player I've seen.
Ever.
Wow. I think so.
Well, we have a lot of football to watch before this next class is announced. And can't wait for that football that's on the way. Speaking of which, let's talk a little SEC, Alabama, the Dynasty. With Brad Edwards, he's coming up next here on Sports Night on FM Talk 106.5. How I feel right now, man. It's your boy Kanye Chitta. Shutdown, what's going on? Back FM Talk 106.5 Sports Night. Dalton Orwig, Corey LeBounty, Ian Blair, and man, we are so close to official kickoff time for the NCAA and the SEC, just weeks away. And well, you know, we're here in Mobile. We do a lot of Alabama Crimson Tide talk. We are the Auburn radio station for this area, so of course we talk Tigers, but really it's an SEC thing down here. And it's great now to talk with Brad Edwards, former ESPN college football guy, and his words on his Twitter profile, and has a book coming out this week. Brad, thank you so much for coming on with us tonight.
Yeah, I appreciate you guys having me. Yeah, the book is going to be out sometime in the next few days. The crazy thing with the books is that I know what day it's going to leave the printer. Mm-hmm. I don't know for sure which day it's going to arrive at the warehouse, and then whether there'd be a one-day lag before they start shipping out orders. So I'm hesitant to give the exact day, but at some point in the next 3 days, people will be able to start placing orders.
That's great, and obviously good timing leading into this season. It's called Dynasty by the Numbers, about Alabama, why Alabama now owns the greatest decade-plus run in college football history. What sets you off on this path to write this book?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because if you're either a fan of Alabama or just a fan of college football, you're well aware of how much they've dominated. And it's gone on for so long now that they've piled up, you know, numbers and accomplishments that are, you know, quite honestly, unparalleled, you know, in college football history, some of them, and then others just, you know, within modern times of the sport. And, you know, I was aware of a lot of them as the years have gone on. And it was funny that, you know, after they won the 2017 national championship, I was thinking to myself, you know, like there's probably enough there to write a book about it. And of course, that was right before they became unstoppable on offense. And so after the last 3 years, what they've done on that side of the ball, then they go win another national title with arguably the greatest offense in the history of the sport. I knew there was enough, and it just coincided with the time that ESPN said my time there was up. I was one of about 300 people whose positions were eliminated at the end of last season. And so I'm like, what am I going to do next? And I'm like, oh, I'll write the book. And so, I just put it all together, and there was so much stuff there, and even more that I, you know, came up with when I really started thinking through it. And what it does is it really explains, not that Alabama's been the best program in college football since 2008. I think that's obvious to even the Alabama haters out there.
Right.
But what the book shows is how much better they have been than even the second best teams. Over that span, I say teams plural, because depending on the category, it might be a different team, but they're just, it's category after category where there's this chasm between Alabama and everyone else, and then the totality of all of it. When you go from, you know, front to back in this book, you start to realize this is stuff that no program in the history of college football, and we're talking about a little bit more than 150 years, mm-hmm. no one has been able to sustain this for as long as Alabama has, you know, at this level. And so it's special, and Alabama fans, I think, have rightfully become spoiled watching it year after year, and they take it for granted. And I'm hoping that, you know, this book will allow them to maybe appreciate how amazing it is what they've been able to witness, you know, in recent years. And if they can't appreciate it now, maybe they can take the book off the shelf in 10 or 15 years and appreciate it then.
Well, I'll tell you what, I am a diehard Alabama fan on the record. I mean, my blood runs crimson through and through here, as my co-host is a diehard Tennessee Volunteer fan. But I will say this, when you start talking about what does a dynasty mean? What does it take to build a dynasty? What amazes me the most is the way and the versatility that Nick Saban has shown. Because when he inherited that team and lost to Louisiana Monroe, he didn't want any more of those guys. I mean, one of Alabama's greatest receivers, DJ Hall, he didn't fit and buy into Nick Saban's system. And here comes Julio Jones down the pipe, and now you're a run-first team in 08 all the way pretty much until 14. And then all of a sudden, you have this transformation with new coaches, new coordinators, new ideas. The coordinators, offense, defense, and special teams have changed, but the winning has not.
It is amazing. And all the stuff you just said, I mentioned in the book because that's part of this. And I think that's what's allowed Saban to continue it for as long as he has, and for longer than anyone has ever been able to continue something like this before, mm-hmm. is because he has successfully made those adjustments. Usually that's what ends a dynasty, is when there's some sort of change that has to be adjusted to and the coach isn't able to make the adjustments. Like you were saying, whether that's, okay, you've got to come up with a different way to play defense because offenses have changed, or you've got to come up with a different way to play offense than what had been working for you before, or there are new rules in recruiting, or you're losing assistant coaches and you got to be able to replace them with guys who are just as good. And oh, by the way, one thing we didn't mention, Alabama has lost underclassmen into the NFL draft,
right.
And especially guys taking the first two rounds, at a higher rate than any program ever before. And so you put all that together, and I mean, it's common sense that it would have ended it. You know, like it defies all logic for him to have survived all things and kept this going. And I think that really speaks to, you know, what has made Saban different is his ability to adjust. Now, of course, part of that comes with him being so hands-on. You know, we always hear every time the next offensive coordinator comes in that it's not that guy's offense, it's Alabama's offense. You know, and this is and the Alabama offense today is not what it was 10 years ago.
Right.
You know, Saban has continued to evolve it, but he does it in a way that it's what he believes is going to work. And, you know, he allows each coordinator to kind of, you know, put his own touches on it. But at the end of the day, it's what Saban wants to do and what he believes is going to be successful. And, I mean, up to this point, who could possibly argue with it?
Right. We're talking with Brad Edwards. You can follow him on Twitter at JBradEdwards. Book coming out this week, The Alabama Dynasty by the Numbers, Why Alabama Now Owns the Greatest Decade-Plus Run in College Football History. And I do want to talk about the future here in a minute, but with everything you just laid out there, Brad, what to you is more impressive, the dominance in recruiting year over year for Alabama, or his ability to, no matter who the assistant coaches are, to just keep on rolling? Both of those seem so impressive to me, and I think are the two reasons why they're such a good dynasty, like you said.
Yeah, and I think they're connected, obviously, because the assistant coaches have to do a lot of the recruiting themselves. And so if he was just hiring guys who were really good on the field coaches who couldn't recruit, you know, that one part would have affected the other. And so I think when you really get down to it, and you could say, all right, you know, for a big chunk of this dynasty, Saban was heavily involved in the defense, and he may still be, you know, very, very heavily involved. I know there were times when it almost felt like, okay, this is Saban's defense right here. Mm-hmm. Like he's kind of calling the shots to some degree. And so you could look at the coaching part and say, okay, he had such a hand in that, but there's no way for him to do everything on the recruiting front as much as he does. There's just too many prospects out there and all that. So I would say the recruiting part has probably been more impressive or more unlikely, I guess is the way to say it. It's also impressive, but to be able to continue to pile up classes for this long, and I realize people would say success breeds success, and as long as you keep putting guys in the NFL at the rate that he is, the recruits are going to continue to come, and they're going to want to be a part of it, and all that's true. But when you've been going for as long as he has, you know, there's all this negative recruiting that's going on where everyone's trying to sell these five-star, high four-star guys on the idea that, okay, Saban's getting old and he's, you know, right, he's not going to be there much longer. You know, back at the beginning when he first started it, everyone was trying to sell people on that he wasn't going to stay at Alabama. He was going to go back to the NFL. He was going to go to another school. And he's been able to overcome all of that and be able to just continue to get the very best to want to come play for him. And, you know, that's the thing that I think is probably more remarkable when you look at it. And, look, I've said it in a number of places, and I think, you know, any coach would tell you that if you ask him what is the number one ingredient to being successful in football, he'd say talent. I mean, above everything else.
Yeah.
But you can't win on talent alone. But if you don't have talent, you know, you can only go so far. And so that's where it all starts. And I don't know anybody's ever been better than him as far as stockpiling talent.
Hey, Brad, this is Ian, the producer of the show. I had a quick question for you. We're talking about coaches and recruiting. I want to kind of shift the gear more towards the focus of the players that have gone through the crimson and white here for a second. In your opinion, after covering this dynasty here for however long the writing process has been, and even before that, who are either the best or the most impactful players, in your opinion, that have gone through that program while Saban has been head coach?
Wow. Okay. So I think I would start with Julio Jones,
right?
Because as a recruit, he might have been the most important guy Saban landed. You know, because that 2008 recruiting class was the one that really jump-started everything. And while there were a number of stars in that class and a number of guys who went on to have great NFL careers, Julio was not only the one that – I guess what I would say, he's the one he had to have, right? Like some of these other guys were out of state, like a Mark Ingram. If Mark Ingram had gone to Michigan State or somewhere else, like that wouldn't have been a loss for Saban. But to lose a guy from Alabama, because apparently Julio was seriously considering Oklahoma, if I remember that correctly.
Yeah.
And, you know, for him to have lost a guy in state at a time when he was trying to take that next step could have been a major setback. So I would say Julio, just because of his profile as a recruit and obviously what he contributed on the field, just really dominating even as a true freshman. Mm-hmm. Was a huge player. And then, you know, I mean, we could obviously sit here and just, you know, name 10, 15 guys, but I would say Tua would be another one just because of the role that he played in changing the offense. Certainly, you have to give some credit to Lane Kiffin for changing Alabama's offense in his 3 years as the coordinator and little things he did, you know, such as putting in some up-tempo, adding the quarterback run. There were a number of things that he contributed, but it was really Tua's ability to throw the ball. And, of course, at the time, we had no idea how talented the receivers were who came in that same class with him. We know now. But I would say that what Tua was able to do from the second half of that national championship game, you know, all the way through his time as the starter, just took that offense to a whole new level at a time when the sport had reached a point where you could no longer win at the highest level without a great offense.
Right.
You know, after so long, Alabama won with a good offense and a great defense, And it was at that time when it was changing, and I think we would all acknowledge now, a great defense and a, you know, average to good offense is probably not going to win the national title. You're going to have to be top tier offensively to have any chance these days, because the very best offenses are just so difficult to stop. And that's why I think Tua was a huge player.
Those are two great answers there, Brad. Talking with Brad Edwards, book out this week, Dynasty by the Numbers, regarding the Alabama Dynasty. And just one more question here for you. I want to talk a little bit about this year and all that you've mentioned so far about recruiting and all that. We've entered a completely new era now with the NIL rules, name, image, and likeness. We've already seen Bryce Young capitalize. I think Nick Saban is already taking advantage of that for recruiting purposes, and I think the dominance will continue. But I want to talk about this year coming up. Alabama hasn't repeated since 2012. They won 2011, 2012. And since then, every time they've won, which has been three times, they have yet to win again the following year. How do you feel about them this year? I mean, you got a – is it Texas A&M's year finally here in the West? Has LSU put things back together since losing all those pros a couple years ago? What are you seeing for Alabama this year?
Yeah, so the first thing I would say is, as much as we have all just pretty much accepted that Alabama's always going to reload, there's no rebuilding, it's just reloading, and that every year they're going to be in the national championship race. And, you know, I'll be up front. I expect them to be again this year, just like everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
But if there was ever a year that they might take a step back, and what's a step back? Two losses, you know? I mean, this would be it, just because of who they lost. I mean, they had six consensus All-Americans on last year's team, and all six of them are gone, and that includes the quarterback. So you lose six guys that good, and, you know, now you've got a quarterback who has never played a meaningful college snap who's going to be in there. And I guess the reason that I don't think it's ultimately going to trip them up is because I look around the country and there's so few teams that have enough talent to have a chance against Alabama, and none of them get Alabama early when all of these guys are going to be so inexperienced, and that could be a major factor. You know, I mean, you mentioned Texas A&M. I mean, Texas A&M gets them kind of in the middle of the season. But A&M's got its own issues as far as, you know, rebuilding or reloading. They've got to, you know, replace all but one starter on the offensive line. They have to replace a four-year starter at quarterback. And while, you know, pretty much everyone else is back, that's a big deal, right? I mean, that's huge for your offensive productivity. And like we said, in an era where you've got to score a lot of points to win. So I have more questions about A&M than I do about Alabama. And then, you know, you look at the other teams that are kind of on Alabama's level. I mean, Georgia obviously can't play Alabama until the 13th game.
Yeah.
You know, Ohio State and Clemson can't play them until at least the 14th game. And so I just think by the time Alabama would play the most talented teams that it would have to face, the inexperience is not going to be a big deal anymore. And so that's why I think that they've got a really good chance to be right where we're expecting. The Miami game is the only one where you would say, okay, maybe this won't be the typical, you know, bloodbath under Saban in the neutral site season opener, just because Miami has so much returning from last year because of the extra year of eligibility and the number of guys who took it. You know, they, like Alabama, got a few key guys in through the transfer portal who should help them. So I think it sets up to be interesting, where there's a chance that it might not be what we're used to seeing for Alabama, but at the same time, I expect it to be. One, because, hey, that transfer portal is there, and, you know, Alabama can fill some of those holes with guys who already have good college experience. And then the other thing, I said this at this time last year, that when we were talking about COVID and the effect it was going to have on the season, and it was going to be very unusual. And I said, look, when things get weird for the players and they're kind of out of their comfort zone, there's no one I would trust more to be able to navigate that as a head coach than Nick Saban. And obviously he did a better job than anyone else at it last year. I'll say the same thing with the name, image, and likeness and the distraction that's going to cause for a whole lot of players as far as now having an opportunity to make money, and there will be plenty of guys around the country who become so distracted by that and worry about their brand and how many followers they have, what's their bank account look like, that maybe they're not dedicating as much time as they should, you know, to developing as a player. That's a threat to every team out there. But I trust Saban to be able to handle that more than anyone else because of his track record. And, you know, if he does that, then Alabama's going to have another really good year.
Well, great conversation, Brad. All kinds of fantastic information there. And that book coming out this week, I can't wait to check it out, Dynasty by the Numbers, Why Alabama Now Owns the Greatest Decade-Plus Run in College Football History. Thanks so much for joining us tonight, Brad.
Thank you all for having me. I really appreciate it.
You can follow Brad on Twitter at JBradEdwards. And it's that time of year, isn't it, Corey?
We are absolutely
about to kick the ball off. In that Miami game, that'll be interesting, but the Tide 17-point favorites heading into that one, unless it's gone up even further. We'll be back in exactly 1 minute to wrap up Sports Night on FM Talk 106.5. Can I kick? Wrapping it up, FM Talk 106.5 Sports Night. I'm Dalton Orwig. He's Corey LeBounty. And over there, that's Ian Blair running the board. And great conversation there with Brad Edwards. Can't wait to, I guess, is hate reading a thing? Can I hate read that new
book? For you, yes. For you, yes. For me, no.
I'm going to be reading that thing in total disgust. Why are they so good about the Alabama dynasty? But we'll see if they can continue it this year. I have a feeling that they're going to win some games, but we'll have to, you know, wait and see that later. I brought up the Olympics earlier, and the gold medal count, total medal count, U.S. back to domination. We may, and I guess you could include me in this group, may have talked a little early about the U.S. men's basketball team being over and done with for how pathetically they played in the exhibitions and then that first game loss to France, but it was all about KD, wasn't it? It was the Kevin Durant show at the end of the day, and he scored 23. They were behind, well, at least in the semifinal, they were behind at the half. They pretty much dominated Australia late. They were behind to Australia at the half and ended up winning big on that one too, but another gold medal. Team USA basketball gets it done. I still don't think I want to see Popovich behind the bench again.
Well, you know, Pop did his job. He won the gold medal. I'm not a huge Popovich coaching Team USA fan, but he did win the gold medal, and Durant proved why he is one of the top three players on the planet. Again, putting up 29, 30, 30 the last couple Olympics. Three gold medals for him, tying Carmelo Anthony for the most won.
I said they beat Australia. They obviously beat France in that gold medal game, and that was, you know, I almost completely missed it, because I thought they were going to be playing 7 a.m. Saturday morning. This time change completely screwed me. I turned it on at halftime Friday night. I'm like, what's going on? I missed it.
And the thing was, you know, they were only up 5 at the half, but found a way. You know, the inside, Rudy Gobert could pretty much do what he wanted to, because they just didn't have that big to defend. Mm-hmm. But when you have Kevin Durant scoring 29 or 30 points the way he was, he showed why he earned his gold medal. And people don't realize this. You are just coming off the NBA playoffs, NBA World Championship for a couple of the players. They're not getting paid to do that. They came to represent their country, which they did in an ultimate and wonderful fashion.
Did I see a stat that Holiday and Middleton were the only people to win gold after winning a national championship?
World Championship? I want to say there's not that many. There's only been a couple that have done so, because you look at when Michael Jordan and the Bulls won it. You're looking in Barcelona. They turn around. They were NBA World Champions. Okay. So Michael Jordan. So it has been done before, but it's not something that happens that often.
LeBron also did it. I think the last time somebody had done it was LeBron James right before 2012. And then I think Kyrie was on that 2016
Cavs team.
Yeah, he was on that Olympic team. I think
you're right,
too.
Yeah.
So Kyrie as well. So yeah, I mean, crazy stats, man.
And a little fun NIL fact for you. Brad there mentioned Miami in that game against Alabama. De'Aaron King signed an NIL deal. He's the quarterback at Miami with the NHL's Florida Panthers. He's getting paid to go to NHL games this year.
How much? Does it say?
No pay disclosed yet. We'll have to see what that one is. But that's certainly the most out-of-the-box NIL deal I've seen to this point. That does it. Another episode of Sports Night done with. You can check out the podcast later, and we'll be back next week. Coming up next, Sweet Home, Canabama.